You know, the microbiome is the theater of activity for a lot of these biotics, but it's not necessarily the lever by which health is manipulated by a biotic.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's podcast is a little bit different from the ones we've done up to now, in that we're going to have a discussion with our past president, ISAP past president Dan Merenstein, and our current president, Maria Marco. So Dan and Maria, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here.
And the idea was we'd just have a chat, I think, about things that have maybe impressed us over the last year or so in the field of biotics, prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics, symbiotics, fermented foods, any of the areas that ISAP cover, and maybe a glimpse into the future as well. So we were challenged to come up with something that during the year, a scientific moment that was personally memorable or impactful. So Maria, can you kick us off with something that you found personally impactful or memorable?
Well, you know, taking over as president of the board was certainly impactful and memorable. And so I'm so grateful for the leadership of Dan and then the past presidents. And working with Marla has just been a joy, really doing such a wonderful job with her leadership of ISAP. But if I could focus in on a scientific contribution that I'm particularly fond of, and no bias when I point out work that I've been focused on, but we have a new paper just out in Nature Microbiology, and it's result of one of our famous ISAP discussion groups started back in 2022. And we were in a discussion group thinking about how much diet, if at all, is taken into account in clinical studies on biotics. And we focused on prebiotics and probiotics. And Colin, it's pretty stark. There's, just one probiotic study that we could find where diet was considered at all, and it wasn't included in the primary endpoints and just kind of secondary analysis. And then even more shocking, I think, is in prebiotics, and just very few, like three studies we could find, only one with sort of a clinical or nutritional endpoint. So we have a lot of work to do. And I think our paper with Kevin Nealon and six other wonderful authors that really focus on nutrition, including dietitians, in the design of these studies. So check out that paper. I think it's could be a good guide.
Can I ask Maria, it's a confounder, right? Yes, yet another confounder. Is it a confounder for health outcomes or for microbiome changes? Both of those, more of one than the other? What's the story?
All of the above, right? And I think if we just pick on prebiotics, where we want them to result in selective enrichment of certain microbes, okay? And we know that diet is a major factor determining the composition and activity of the microbes in our digestive tract. It sort of boggles my mind how we could have one but not the other and take it into account. So it is a confounder. And, you know, there are others. There are going to be others as well. Health status to begin with. But it seems, you know, as we try to tease apart responders, non-responders, impacts, differences between studies, it seems relevant that we should be working with dietitians to design our studies, taking diet at least as a variable that we're considering for the outcomes.
Of course, humans aren't separated into cages and fed prescriptive diets. So is it going to be possible to control for diet in interventions involving biotics?
That's a great question. I don't think a recommendation is to control diet, but to report an habitual diet. Because we know when you prescribe very set diet to people, that's not their normal daily activity. And so you might get artifactual results from that. And so what was the, you know, how much fiber, for example? What is the baseline fiber that somebody's eating? And so when we add in a prebiotic, that may, you know, really change a person's diet, a fiber kind of complex polysaccharide type of fiber intake. So anyway, that was our recommendation.
Yeah, it's a big issue because ISAP just also published a paper in Nature Reviews Gastroenterology and Hepatology on classifying compounds as prebiotics. And just following up our consensus definition papers with guidance on how to conduct those studies. And diet is such an important confounder, and it's inherently difficult to establish the causal linkages between the prebiotic, the microbiota modulation, and the ultimate health outcome. And diet in particular is going to very much confound that last linkage. And so if you're not even measuring it, there's really no hope of really being able to control for the untoward potential influences of confounding by diet.
So Dan, why is it different than any other confounder though? If you have a large enough RCT, why would it just be washed out and group A and group B would be have the same amount of fiber, same amount of, you know, A, B, and C? Why
does it's a great question. Now with the prebiotic, you can randomize who gets the prebiotic or not, and that eliminates concerns about does the prebiotic lead to the health outcome, which is a key thing to establish. It eliminates concerns about confounding for does the prebiotic lead to the microbiota modulation. But what randomization of just the prebiotic doesn't do is eliminate confounding of the linkage between microbiota modulation and the health outcome. And so if you're not aware of what the possible confounders of that are and you're not able to measure them, you have no real hope of eliminating that confounding. And Maria's example is a telling one. If you give somebody prebiotics, that might alter their satiety. They might alter their diet in other ways. That could ultimately lead to a favorable health outcome that has nothing to do with the microbiota modulation per se. It just has to do with the fact that you made them feel fuller and so they didn't take on as much food. Randomization of the prebiotic helps with two of those causal claims, but randomization of the prebiotic doesn't help with eliminating confounding of the linkage between the microbiota modulation and the health outcome.
How would you design that study, though?
Well, it's difficult. You have to think of ways to try to randomize the microbiota modulation. So Kristen Verbecke has these very innovative colon delivery capsules. You know, she can formulate capsules that can target the delivery of a butyrate to the colon. And so you can then randomize who gets those capsules or not and see if that leads to a health outcome. And then the amount of butyrate that you put in the capsules versus the placebo, that has to be somehow tied to a reasonable amount of butyrate that could be ascribed to the enhancement of the microbiota activity. So you'd have to have some sort of double randomization where you randomize prebiotic and then you randomize the microbiota manipulation. Or you have to do some sort of double randomization scheme, and those can be difficult, but they basically involve interfering or enhancing how the mediator works.
Now we're getting lost in the weeds a little bit here. You know, if you take two groups and randomly assign them to a prebiotic or not, and the people on the prebiotic have a better health outcome, isn't that really what we're after? I mean, I know mechanism is important for design and for scientists and for Nature micro papers, but the health outcome surely is the main readout, isn't it?
It's important, but it doesn't mean that the health outcome was achieved by the selective utilization of the substrate by the microbiota. And that's inherent in our definition.
Dan Merenstein, come on. What's your observation from the years?
Yeah, I'll go with the last word out of that, though. I will say that all my trials, I have tons of diet data. And somehow when I give it to the people, microbiome scientists who have, all they have is amazing amount of data. They're overwhelmed by the diet data and they do not look at the diet data. So we have to. So you need right ways to recommend. Maybe you're right. The fiber is the first hurdle. Maybe I should just give them the fiber data. Maybe I should just do that. But we have people spending hours and hours trying to collect data of people's diet, and it's just sitting in my lab doing nothing. Anyway, so if you can make a recommendation, I would say I know everyone didn't get to go to ISAP. I'm sorry about that. But we had a really good discussion about the role of probiotics in the NICU, which I thought was really exciting. And actually, I think it led to the FDA holding a symposium just about 8 weeks ago. They had a full day of the same idea, the role of the probiotics in NICU. And I still think looking at the statements they made, they're probably still going to take them a little bit of time to make changes. But I think there is movement in the air. And we've been talking about...
Can you give us the background to that, please?
Yeah, I think we've been talking about for a while that probably one of the best evidence for outcomes that you were talking about, health outcomes, is to give premature babies probiotics for multiple reasons. But it does seem like it's the best outcome to prevent a horrible disease called NEC and to prevent sepsis and ultimately death, real important outcome. And for lots of reasons, they haven't been used. Heterogeneity and trial design, they weren't done under FDA, under drug studies, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the data is being so overwhelming that even the FDA is starting to listen. And I hope that, in next few years, this will at least be an option for parents who have a premature baby. Because right now, because of the way the FDA has been, I think, scaring physicians away from using them, is not really an option, at least in the U.S. And I can't speak for the rest of the world, but in the U.S. as much as it should be.
Can you give us some sense of those? You said that the evidence is overwhelming. Can you give us some sense of the numbers there? Because I've heard various numbers of, fatalities with and without probiotics, and they do seem extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't know if Dan T might know it off the top of his head, but do you, Dan, know the numbers? You're muted.
The number needed to treat to prevent a death from NEC or sepsis is so much smaller, like it's orders of magnitude smaller than the number needed to harm, like the number of children that get an adverse effect of the probiotic, which is typically like some sort of contamination or translocation or something leads to a bad outcome. And the bad outcomes that you get from the infection tend not to be fatal, whereas the NEC itself is often very fatal. So it is one of those things where it's orders of magnitude difference between the number of lives potentially saved and the potential harm. And so balancing the benefits to the harms is what we expect the FDA to be able to do. And they've reacted, rightly so, to some concerns about harms from, infection, but they've maybe not balanced quite right the evidence in favor of it. I don't have the exact numbers handy, but I think all orders of magnitude.
I think Jeff Frieda's presented at the ISF that the meta-analysis are so robust and so large to end that you would need an RCT of like 18,000 people to actually change the data, to be a negative RCT to change. So really, there's no studies going to be done to really change the data. It's just going to have to be regulatory authorities deciding to do anything. I think there is a question of what product is the best, and maybe we need to do studies of product versus A versus B, but there seems to be no question that their evidence is there.
And do you think that good scientific evidence, will drive change in regulatory agencies? I mean, we saw it with FMT, I guess. I mean,
I think FMT is a perfect example. FMT, they drew pretty quickly. I think in the U.S. now, it's impossible to predict anything. I think that there's different people taking over the FDA who actually might be more open to this, definitely more open to supplements. So it's possible that things could really change in the next, 1 or 2 years even. But no one could predict, at least.
The challenge we have is that what do we mean by good science? Because science always has methodological flaws, and there's sort of a trade-off between the methodological weaknesses that somewhat discount the impacts of a particular study and the findings from a particular study and what the potential impacts of those findings are. You have to have a lot of good judgment to be able to look at a study that wasn't conducted in the most absolutely perfect way, because perfect is basically unattainable. There aren't resources available for us to do studies that lack any methodological flaws at all. So how do you balance a judgment about the results from a study that's flawed, as every single scientific study is, with, the potential concerns about how those flaws might influence the results?
Maria, do you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, what struck me in the panel discussion earlier this year was the patient advocacy piece. That really, I think, is a central factor that brings it really home to everyday, all of us, everyday lives, for parents to be involved in the decision making. And what was shocking is how they're not in the hospital setting. So yeah, that I think would be a huge step forward, to actually have some guidance. And, of course, physicians vary in their understanding, their training, their interest in this area, probiotics. So anyway, that I thought was what made the event really important.
And Dan M., you work in this area. I mean, are probiotics literally prohibited from use in NICU, or just simply not advocated or encouraged?
Well, there was an unfortunate death, I guess maybe 2 years ago now. The FDA sent a letter out, and pretty much most hospitals in the U.S. then shut it down after that. You can do it if you do it through a research study, but the letter is stated in such a pretty much is not worth it to do it. And I think the new surveys show almost no one is doing it in the U.S. So now, so it's not as strongly as prohibited, but it's just there's too many obstacles to do it.
And is it being reflected on the ground with more morbidity and mortality?
I think we'll see that. I think we'll see that. Yeah. I mean, the data says we'll see that. I mean, I don't know if we're far off. I think we'll see that.
Yeah. Yeah, there are going to be organized efforts to collect that data and see what impacts it has. Fortunately, neonatologists have been really great at reducing morbidity and mortality outcomes. And so there's sort of an overall reduction, fortunately. But the expectation that a lot of us have is that the observational data are going to reveal that there were impacts of the dramatic reduction in the use of probiotics. Now, of course, those are going to be observational data. So then some people are going to say that they're subject to confounding biases. And that's the sort of trade-offs that I'm talking about. Like the studies have flaws in that there's some amount of confounding. The question that an astute judge has to address is whether or not the confounding explains away all of the effects you're seeing. So,
yeah, another great topic for discussion.
I wanted to load a question back to Dan Abb. So are you a member now of National Academy of Medicine, or is there, are you in the big club?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I am. I think very much because of ICEP, to be honest. I mean, when the statement came out, they said due to my primary care trials settings, and over 90% of those trials are probiotic trials. So I think I owe a lot to the biotic family and the probiotics. In fact, the first person I called was Mary Ellen. So Mary Ellen Sanders, who all of you know very well. So yes, I am. So thank you very much.
That's a very prestigious honor. And that was what I was going to note was one of my highlight of the year was learning about Dan being elected to the National Academy of Medicine. And he very graciously attributed that to the National Academy recognizing the importance of primary care. And I've always, even before I knew Dan and his attention to the rigor of primary care study, I've admired the rigor with which he brings it. So it's exciting to see him have that platform because we need more rigorous primary care research of the sort that Dan does.
Oh, thank you all very much.
In terms of, there's a lot of highlights from the past year. The thing that kind of struck me is one of the upshots from a discussion group or a task force that ISAP convened in 2023, and we published our findings in, this past year about the state of the evidence about whether or not probiotics can help protect against antibiotic disrupted microbiota. And that's one of those things that you would think there would be very conclusive evidence of that. There's a lot of reasons to think that's true, but somewhat surprisingly, we weren't able to find conclusive evidence. And it's largely due to lack of methodological rigor or not being able to rule out confounding or studies just not really directly addressing the question that we have. So that's kind of the thing about science. There's a lot of stuff we suspect is true, but actually establishing it with conclusive evidence is the challenge. And so I'm looking forward to us developing more rigorous methodology for measuring things and delivering targets, delivering interventions to the colon. Our challenge, of course, especially with gut health, is that we have easy access to stool, but we don't necessarily have access to what's going on inside the gut. And we need to develop better measurement strategies for that, I think.
Glad you brought up that study because I left the board of ISAP this year after serving for, far too long. And, what I'm most proud of, I guess, of ISAP is that could be perceived as a negative study, a negative outcome. But yet ISAP wasn't afraid to call it. Like the evidence pointed that direction. And so, as you say, it could be methodological in origin, but that we didn't shy away from it because it didn't reflect maybe what common concept would be that it's always good to take a probiotic if you're going on an antibiotic.
Yeah.
I think that's great to see that rigor being applied and following the science, not following the mythology, if you like. I don't know. Dan or Maria, do you have any reaction to that?
In fact, we had a paper the year before. We also came out with, what was it, Dan? That probiotics are not used, not everyone should take a probiotic. I forget the title of the We got a lot of pushback. But again, I totally agree with you. We're not cheerleaders. I've always said that. We're scientists. And I think Dan's paper, the antibiotic paper, is a really important paper because in my field, I think it's probably the number one reason we use probiotics. I think it's almost standard of care in the U.S. when you give an antibiotic to talk about a probiotic. And the assumption is because you're protecting the microbiome or, But we don't know what we're doing, it seems like, you know, like, so I think we need to be more rigorous in that.
Honestly,
I think it goes back to Colin's original point. We probably do know that it helps with diarrhea. So there's something it's doing there, the outcome that maybe you're most worried about, but the mechanism and how will be interesting. Sorry.
Yeah, let's be careful to point out, we do believe that probiotics do lead to favorable benefits, especially in that context when you're taking antibiotics. But what we don't know is that benefit achieved by it robustifying or restoring the gut microbiome. So the paper...
Yeah, but if you ask someone why they're why a doctor why they're doing it, that's why they're doing it. I'm giving you this probiotic to protect your microbiome or to restore it once the antibiotic kills all your... Maybe that's just simple talk, but that's what they say when they give it.
Yeah.
Right. But in the paper that we published last year, Dan, we didn't say in the context of a person taking antibiotics, should they take a probiotic or not, because we wouldn't.
You weren't giving clinical advice. Yeah, you weren't.
The paper we did last year was just for a generally healthy person. How strong is the evidence that they ought to be taking probiotics? And we used a very high standard, the one that the United States Preventive Services Task Force used. And we didn't find that right now any of the evidence reaches that very high level for healthy populations.
There is a kind of a shorthand emerging, I think, in the field maybe, that regarding the microbiome itself, almost as a health outcome or something that we have to intervene in. And, you know, the microbiome is the theater of activity for a lot of these biotics, but it's not necessarily the lever by which health is manipulated by a biotic.
And there's so much we don't know yet about what's going on in the microbiota and how that impacts health. So we really have so much to learn.
Yeah.
Colin, what have you found interesting or impactful in the past year?
Well, something I'm always very, aware of is that sometimes the microbiome field and by extension then into the biotics fields, we let ourselves off the hook a little bit, I think, on numeracy. We accept things like relative abundance. Our terminology is not always very good. And I think there was a lovely paper this year in Cell by Pierre Bork's lab that showed that the actual overall abundance of microbes in fecal samples, again, I would always push for people to say they're looking at the fecal microbiome or the fecal bacteriome, which is the normal thing people look at, rather than just saying the gut microbiome as if we're looking at the entire gut. And it's yet another confounder. And, we don't need any more confounders. The virome, the phages that we look at, they're another confounder. There's confounder on confounder on confounder. But I think we've been giving ourselves maybe too easy a ride and ignoring these confounders. Diet now, again, of course, being another. And I'm glad to see that rigor is coming into the field. I think it's absolutely necessary. We can't give ourselves an easy out. We can't avoid the fact that the GI tract is 30 feet long. There's probably, at least 30 different microbiomes in there. There's the bacterium, the virome, the parasitome, the mycome, and we're looking through an incredibly blurry lens when we look at fecal bacteriomes and making some pretty profound conclusions based on a very blurry lens. So I'm glad that this kind of rigor is coming into the field.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment, Colin. I completely agree. It is much more complex than we let ourselves leave sometimes. But I think we're also kind of sometimes swimming upstream and how we're conveying these complex ideas to the general public, to the lay public. And it's a challenge because as we were talking about, giving probiotics to change the microbiome, right? That might not really be the reason that they could work. What is a fermented food, right? And the microbes in fermented foods not being probiotic. So it we're kind of taking it from both ends here when we talk about these complex issues, and then how do we, as scientists and physicians, relay this to the public and to our patients? So
it's a great point. I always worried that when we have an absence of conclusive evidence for a hypothesis, that gets mistaken by our audience to mean that we have evidence that the hypothesis is wrong. And that's not at all true. Typically, what we have when we convene scientific groups to evaluate a body of evidence is we often find a lack of conclusive evidence, but we've certainly not found conclusive evidence that the hypothesis is wrong.
This opening question was meant to be the first couple of minutes of this podcast, and I think we've actually reached the end of our time.
But I enjoyed it anyway. I hope the three of you did.
Thank you for having us on. Yeah, I appreciate you guys doing this.
Thanks, Maria and Dan.
This was fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.